Greetings, Internet, and welcome to the inaugural episode of the Toncast. I'm your host, Steve Skelton, and I have a very special guest for the first episode of the Toncast. It's Todd Robert Anderson. Welcome, Todd.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a great honor to be on the very first Toncast.
Well, it's very exciting to have you. I'm looking forward to our talk.
I am, too. I'm very excited about this.
Well, let's just jump right in, shall we?
Oh, let's jump in.
And let's find out what we can find out about Todd. Todd Robert Anderson, You're a TV actor.
Oh, yeah, I've appeared on television.
You're a feature film actor.
I've been in feature films, yes.
You're well-known and beloved.
Sure, well, yeah, sure, let's go with that.
What is your earliest memory of being considered extraordinarily special?
Oh, my earliest memory where I realized that people looked upon me as special, I was a child, there was a blizzard. It was in 1978. There was a terrible blizzard.
It was a cold winter in 78.
It was very cold, in Massachusetts where I grew up, and
terrifying.
It was very terrifying. And I was living in a small town called Sherburne in the downtown area in an apartment building. It was an old mansion that had been converted into apartments, and it was my birthday. In 78, which I guess I was born in 72, so that would make it my sixth birthday.
Excellent.
The blizzard hit, and there was 6 feet of snow. That's a lot of snow.
Six feet of snow.
Yeah, it was an enormous amount of snow, you know, even for New England. It was a lot. And it was my birthday, and, you know, I was having some of my friends over. And when I say friends, I mean I was only really sick. So they were just people, you know, my parents knew from around town who had kids my age. I didn't really bond with any of them. And I think ultimately a number of them I wound up despising completely.
That happens a lot with 6-year-olds.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, you change from when you're six. So my dad... for my birthday, which is in January, so obviously, you know, the snow was not melting, built a maze, you know, a labyrinth through the yard of the apartment building,
which took out of snow.
Out of snow. He's dug a really kind of amazing maze in the snow, which when you're six and you can't see over it, is awesome.
Stupefying.
And terrifying.
Yeah.
At the same time, but I realized, wow, if my dad's willing to spend all this time just making a maze for my birthday, clearly I'm incredibly special and people want to do stuff for me.
Absolutely.
And that has continued. That has continued.
Yeah.
I get uncomfortable when people... constantly want to do stuff for me. I have people popping by. A lot of times, even door-to-door salesmen will pop by, and they're in the middle of their pitch, and they realize, I don't even know what I'm doing. I want to give you something.
Yeah.
And, you know, free aluminum siding, whatever.
It's a burden.
It is. It's hard to get free stuff all the time.
Yeah. No, I understand. How would you go about finally, decisively winning the war on terror?
Wow, that's a really tricky question. There's a lot, I think, a lot of gray areas to fighting war on terror. You know, how do you fight it without using racial profiling? How do you fight terror without making one religion the evil thing? And I think the best way to fight a war on terror would be to start a systematic change from the ground up, in which all religions are smashed into one, And that includes any spiritual philosophy, even atheism, the anti-spiritual philosophy.
Anyisms.
Yeah. It would all have to be smashed together into one large religion in which no one can ever possibly be offended by anybody else. But everybody at the same time, you know, is completely free. There's no, you know, discrimination against women or whatever in the religions, and that way there won't be any uprisings, because you don't want any uprisings.
No.
Because a lot of times, you know, an act of terrorism from one point of view can be an uprising against a totalitarian regime from another point of view. So we have to get rid of that, and then we have to also, in addition, have a world government. Now, I think that democracy, you know, is a great thing philosophically, you know, and in an ideal world it is. But having been in the entertainment industry, one thing I realized when you're making a piece of entertainment is you really can't do it democratically. At some point, someone has to be a totalitarian dictator. You just hope that that person is thoughtful and is keeping the best for the show in mind, and that's why if we did the all-encompassing world religion / government, it would probably be best if I ran it.
Oh, excellent! Yes.
Yeah. No, so I'll just run a world religion and a world government. That's together. I mean, the other thing is I would stop the separation of church and state.
As long as it was just one church.
As long as it's just one church and one government, it's one thing, you know.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, like, people will stop making the jokes about American money having "In God We Trust,"
yes,
you know, on the bill, because everybody trusts in God at that point.
Yeah, well, because that's the only one.
And God, but the other thing is God, you know, because that's the other thing is God's always looked on as male. You know, mm-hmm. which is kind of discriminatory towards women, and a lot of people make the joke, you know, or some people just refer to God as a she, but I would make God a hermaphrodite, so that way, you know, nobody's discriminated.
Like, with all the parts, or with no parts? Would it be,
I think it'd be better, I think no parts, then that people are going to confuse God with Barbie or Ken.
Yes.
And I think, think of God as a plastic thing, and I don't think that's good for spirituality. Plastics and spirituality. Mm-hmm. I would keep those separate. I'd bring government and religion together. I'd remove plastics from religion, and there you go. You got a hermaphrodite God, you know.
Well, it's clear you spent a lot of time thinking about this.
I want to fix the world.
It's fantastic.
That's why I got into acting, so I could fix the world.
Describe your favorite pair of pants.
Oh, that's a solid question. My wife, for the most part, dresses me at this point.
It's probably most.
Yeah, I don't really have much fashion sense. So, like, the jeans I'm wearing right now,
they're very nice. Bought.
Yes, they're very nice. Although the kitten has destroyed them already.
That'll
so
happen.
I have to buy a new pair of nice jeans. But the jeans I really prefer, and jeans are my favorite, you know, pant. And because it's casual, but they're rugged, and if you have a kitten, it can latch onto your pants and not destroy your flesh underneath.
Well, and I think, you know, I mean, casual rugged describes you. So.
I am casual rugged. I remember one time I saw a headshot of William Catt, the guy who played the greatest American hero back in the 80s. It was more recent, you know, it was back in the late 90s when I saw this headshot, and it had him just kind of squatting in a, you know, manly squat by a river, with
river.
a scruffy kind of half beard in the middle of the woods, just looking kind of badass, you know, and
like
that's
a riverman, homeless riverman.
Yeah, a homeless riverman, and that's what I think of myself as, is the next homeless riverman, William Catt. So, hence jeans.
Yes.
So, my favorite pair of jeans, I think, right now are the jeans that I've had the longest.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a man's man. You know, it's like I have my clothes that I'm comfortable in, and I don't want to necessarily give them up. And these jeans have been washed so many times, they've really become too short.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I'm wearing them with shoes and socks, they look odd. and maybe offensive to other people, but that's what I'm most comfortable in. But I only really break those out when I'm mowing the lawn at this point.
And do you probably wear like high boots?
I do. I wear work boot for mowing the lawn.
So it's, you can do the work and still look, you know, unoffensive.
Right. I don't look offensive, and I don't, you know, and I don't do shirtless yard work, no matter how hot, you know, it may be. Just, you know. Well, also that excites, you know, certain types of personalities. When they see me without a shirt, they get excited.
Yeah. Well, it's, and you, this is a neighborhood. You have a,
And I respect my neighbors. Yeah.
In what way can people make your life easier?
There's a lot of ways that people can make my life. I mean, do you want me to do a list or just?
The top three.
The top three. Okay. Number one. Everyone except for me could stop driving, stop using cars. That would be extremely helpful. I would accomplish a lot more. I would get to a lot more places more quickly.
You'd make great time.
There would be no road rage, at least not from my end. It would be less dangerous if everyone stopped driving and it was just me who was driving.
Statistically, you can't argue with that statement.
No, I don't think you can. I don't think you can.
Number two.
Another thing people could do to make my life easier is, I'm an actor, of course. I do scripted things where I have to memorize them.
Yeah.
And I have to make choices and preparations. You know, it's a lot of work.
It's hard work.
And you often feel like it goes unappreciated, especially when everybody, instead of watching, you know, a scripted show, most choose reality television.
Yes.
And if I could get people to stop watching reality television altogether, that everything from Cops to American Idol to Oprah, really. Just get rid of all of it. If everybody stopped watching, it would go away, and then there would be more scripted television. And the more scripted television there is, the more jobs there are, and the easier it would be for me to get jobs. And then I could work all the time instead of 6 or 7 days out of the year.
Yeah.
What, you know, that would be another thing people could do.
That'd be a big help.
Yep. Another thing that would be cool if people, that make my life a lot easier, is if there were less societal constraints on sex and sexuality. If it was cool and not, you know, you wouldn't be considered a monster if you had, I don't know, a stable of sex slaves.
Yeah.
You know.
Not more wives?
No, I don't want more wives. I just want the one wife. And because she's great. She's a perfect wife. I want some sex slaves. To have around for parties and when I'm bored, you know. Because you spend a lot of time waiting around as an actor. And if I had sex slaves, I'd probably be less.
It'd pass the time.
Yeah, it would pass the time. Something to do.
All right, excellent. Todd, what is the most difficult obstacle you've ever had to overcome triumphantly?
The most difficult... Oh, that's a good question. I think when I was... this is another childhood story. My hometown... small town again, just to remind you, very small. They, you know, during the summers, they're always trying to come up with something to do. There was often a fair to raise money for the school, where there was, you know, booze and stuff, dunking booths, and you get pies and stuff. Raffle.
Oh yeah.
I won a 15-pound lobster actually.
Absolutely amazing.
It was. I don't really like a lobster, but it was certainly big.
But 15 pounds, that's nothing to sneeze at.
No, you can't. If you win that, clearly God has chosen you.
Something special.
That's not just luck.
No, that just doesn't happen.
No, that's God. That's a message. There was an annual canoe race down the Charles River, which goes through, you know, Massachusetts. And it was the hometown. You know, it was a good humored affair. It was, you know, there was an entry fee, and it was for charity and stuff.
It's in the spirit of friendly competition.
Okay. But part of the contest was making your canoe look as ridiculous as possible. So you were judged in the canoe race as one, you know, where you place, who comes in first, second, third, fourth, fifth, right on down to usually there were 30 or 40 boats. And then the other thing you get judged on was how hilarious your canoe was.
Outrageous canoe.
So I had a friend who was a little eccentric. Mm-hmm. He was an eccentric guy. Very, very smart, not 100% socially comfortable. But you know, a good person,
Like William Cat squatting by the river.
Yeah, like that guy.
Yeah.
But really smart. Instead of I'm not saying William Cat's dumb. I'm just saying in a lot of the movies,
I don't have those numbers.
The straight to video movies I've seen, he often plays less than intelligent guys. You know, and that's probably just good acting. That's, you know, in Greatest American Hero, he was kind of a buffoon.
Yeah.
But that's acting.
Yeah.
You know,
nice.
So the William Cat that is presented by fiction, you know, that's...
We just don't know.
We don't know. But anyway, so this guy is, you know, William Cat, awkward, but, you know, really smart. And he thought it would be funny, because he had an old chicken coop in his backyard, to somehow build a boat out of a chicken coop. And
that is kind of a wild idea.
It's a crazy idea. And I'm a yes and, always have been.
Oh, yeah.
Before I was even trained as an improvisational expert.
Natural, it was natural.
A comic genius that I became. I said, let's build it out of a chicken coop. So we had to devise a way to make a chicken coop float.
It's no small task.
Yeah, it's not easy. And something that we had access to, because I suggested styrofoam, because I had a raft of the lake that we summered at, and there were giant pieces of styrofoam built into the wood that made it float. So I thought, hey, why don't we put a big piece of styrofoam?
It's buoyant.
But we priced styrofoam. It's pretty expensive.
Yeah.
Styrofoam is not as cheap as you would think. At least it wasn't back then.
Then
styrofoam was really popular. And so we sort of looked around the yard, and his mom was an early recycler. So she collected her, you know, and that was, you know, separate it all out back then. You couldn't just dump everything recyclable into a bin like you can now, so other people could sort it out. You had to do it yourself if you were serious.
Yeah, you had to be committed.
If you were serious.
Yeah.
So he had a giant, you know, bin of old plastic milk jugs. So what we did was we sealed them shut with duct tape. And then we tied him on in the chicken coop, and lo and behold, it floated.
Yeah.
So we entered ourselves as the floating chicken coop into the canoe race, which was taking some liberties with the fact that it's supposed to be a canoe race, and you're supposed to design something silly in a canoe.
But you were thinking outside.
Well, we were kids, and we were thinking outside of the canoe. Exactly. So we put it on the river for the race, and the thing about chicken coop. A rectangular chicken coop made out of wire and plywood with milk jugs keeping it afloat. The thing about it is it's not as easy to get to paddle it.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have the pointy bow.
Yeah, it's not
you
the
know,
resistance
that
in the water.
Your standard canoe. Yeah, there's a lot of resistance. Yeah. So
it's just barely seaworthy.
Yeah, yeah. It really was... there were a lot of errors in the judgments that we made, but we were kids and we were thinking,
being a kid is all about, making mistakes.
When we come in first on that chicken coop, we're going to get first prize and we're going to get the first prize for craziest thing. So, all the canoes finished way well before we did. And a lot of small town folk were waiting around on a bridge for us to, because it went from one bridge
to the next.
So they were waiting, you know, for us to, and a couple of people came back on their canoes and tied us to their canoes to try and help us get there a little quicker. But we came in.
That's just small town hospitality.
That was very nice. But we did finish, and that was a bitter sweet triumph that we got the floating chicken coop from one place to another. But we were kids, so we were very upset and a little bit humiliated that we'd done that. It was kind of stupid ultimately. And we were both very upset. He was crying, and then I was doing that sympathetic friend fake cry.
Yeah,
you know, because I was just glad to be out of the water at that point and wanted to go home. But he was very upset because it was sort of his brainchild. But then the guy who ran the thing, the boat race, who's handing out the prizes. One of my parents, I think it was my dad, actually knocked on the window of the car where we were upset and said, "Come out, come out! They want to honor you with something." And so, you know, tears were being dried, and I didn't really have to dry any. I just had to pretend to dry the tears. So we walked, and they had a prize, a special prize, made up last minute just for us. Which is amazing, but they had a lot of time.
Well, yeah, because they had a lot of time between. But they did.
But they did it, and it was amazingly thoughtful and good humored. And the towel said, "Thank God it didn't sink." And we each got our own towel that said, "Thank God it didn't sink," and commemorated the race on it. And I thought that was a kind of a nice triumph, and we overcame a lot. It's not easy to push or paddle a chicken coop down a river.
It's an amazing story of triumph.
It is. My life is filled with those triumphs.
Now, Todd Robert Anderson is an accomplished film and television actor.
I can't argue with that.
Walk us through your process of creating one of your unforgettable roles.
I'd be happy to. Is there a particular role you have in mind?
I just pick one of your favorites.
Sure. There's a. I've had a commercial for Liberty Mutual running for a number of years now. This is a good commercial. It's cool. It's me as the dad and a little kid who's my son. And we're washing our car, but the car has been destroyed, and I guess in a lot of fender benders, because it's filled with dents, and it's got broken glass. And as we're washing the car, the dents all magically disappear. And then by the time we're done with the car wash, the car is perfect.
It's incredible.
And it was, you know, they used special effects, both practical and computer generated, to create the illusion of this broken down car being washed back into perfection. The idea being that Liberty Mutual, you know, of course, is your car wash.
Yeah, and they'll make your car indestructible.
In order to be a believable dad, there's no dialogue in the spot, which, you know, a lot of people say, well, you have to memorize lines, but no, I mean, the less you talk, the harder it is to convey something. And I had to convey convincingly that I was washing a car with my son. Mm-hmm. Now, my real life son is, at the time, was only, four.
So that was a total year off.
Yeah, and and the kid in the commercial was 9, I think.
Oh, that's even more.
I have no idea what it means to have a 9-year-old kid. So it's completely different from my life. And I don't wash my own car. No. I go to the car wash. So there's another thing. Yeah. I did used to have to wash my parents' car as one of my, you know, chores as a kid. So I had to do sense memory exercises.
You had to go back
and to get back in that place. You know, what is the sponge smell like? What is the car washing soap feel like when you mix it with the water?
Where's the bucket?
What does the bucket sound like? What is the water from the hose hitting going into the bucket sound like? What do the suds feel like on the car? What do they look like? What, you know? And so I spent at least maybe 30 or 45 seconds doing that before I walked to set. But that's, I mean, I'm discounting all the prep I had to do before I even did that, which was I had to go on an audition.
Mm-hmm.
and pretend I was washing a car in an audition.
And there wasn't even a car.
There wasn't a car.
Yeah.
There wasn't a car. So there wasn't anything.
That, in some ways, that's even harder.
That's even harder. And the commercial auditions, they don't give you a lot of time to prepare. You always hear stories about guys who have to prepare something. De Niro puts on 30 pounds and, you know, hangs out with cops for 4 days in order to, you know, really get into the role for yeah. Righteous Kill yeah. or whatever.
But you can't.
You can really see that in that yeah. movie. It's just that performance really blew me away. Righteous Kill is just, it's an American classic.
He's a master.
He's American. Master. And him and Pacino together, just between Pacino's just desperate yelling and De Niro's underplayed to the point of almost looking bored, those two energies smashing off of each other.
Oh, it's like a nuclear bomb hitting a volcano.
It really was just a great movie. But this is a little different because I don't have the time. You know, they call you, the day before or the day of the auditions, you got to go. And then you sometimes, you know, you don't know if they're going to call you to show up, you know, on the set the next day sometimes. So there's not a lot of place for preparation. But for this particular job, I found out I was going to do the commercial 2 days before. So for those 2 days, I just went about my normal life. And then when it came time for the shoot, I got in my car and I drove all the way to the set.
You drove yourself?
I drove myself all the way to the set. It was shot on location in Pasadena. So I had to drive from North Hills, California, which is near Northridge, all the way to Pasadena.
Did you get down to the 101 or did you take like...
No, to make sure I didn't get caught in rush hour traffic.
Yeah.
Because to me, it's very important to show up on time.
You're a professional.
If you're getting paid. Yeah. And even if you're not, if you've agreed to do something, you should show up on time. What I did to make sure that I would get to Pasadena on time is I actually got on the 405 north instead of south.
Oh.
Got on the 118, okay,
right.
Headed east, and then I got on the 210.
Amazing.
And took that out.
Amazing.
Out to Pasadena. And then I got there, and before I went on set, I had to... Oh, there was a wardrobe fitting. I had to go in and try on clothes. And the clients and everybody, they looked at me and decided which clothes they wanted me to wear. So I had to get in and out of clothes. And then, of course, when I got to set, I put on the chosen wardrobe. And then I waited. I read a book. I think it was reading World War Z. So I read that for a couple of hours. Occasionally I would go to craft services.
Keep your strength up.
I would get some, maybe coffee and a water and, maybe some, dried fruit and nuts. I stay away from the high sugar things because I don't want my energy to crash.
Yeah, you want
to. Cause I was going to be washing a car for a number of hours.
You got to be consistent.
Yeah. It's only a 30-second commercial, but it takes a whole day of washing a car.
A lot of people don't understand that.
Yeah. That a lot of them don't. And so, those are just a lot of the troubling, tough things that an actor's got to deal with when shooting, you know, a TV commercial. And never mind, you know, when I've done TV shows. I mean, I did a show the other day or the other week where it was a guest star role on a new sitcom, and they called me that day.
Yeah.
To audition, and then at the end of the audition, they said, "Okay, you got to go to set because we're going to shoot this right now." No preparation.
Yeah.
I was playing a man on an elevator. I had no time to research.
How do you do that in the same day?
It's a matter of if you're doing it all the time. Sometimes you got to have a little blind faith.
Had you been on an elevator recently?
I had not. Uh-huh. I had not been on an elevator in quite some time. And this is a lot of elevators in LA are just, you know, they're going up one, maybe three floors tops.
Yeah.
This was an elevator. I'm not 100% sure because I didn't read the script for the show that I was on, but
you didn't have time.
It felt like a probably a pretty big you know, condo building that I was in. So and it's been a long time since I've been on a long elevator ride. So
several floors, we're talking.
And I had, I just had to make it believable.
Yeah.
And
dig deep. You had to dig deep.
I had to dig deep, yeah. And it was hard. There was a lot of improv there, but a lot of life experience that I was pulling from. I had to remember when I was in New York, and I got on an elevator in New York.
And it took a long time.
It took a long time because it was a big building.
Well, that's just amazing. I mean, the craft.
That's the thing.
It's impressive.
Yeah, the way the business works too. You never know, so you want to research as much as possible. Without even knowing what part you might play. Yeah. So ride those elevators. You take a train.
Wash a car.
Yeah. Take a train. Look at some maps because you never know. You could play a map guy.
Well, you know, and in that vein, what is the television role that has meant the most to you and to all that have seen it?
Let's see. The TV role that meant the most to me... that a lot of people saw. That's a tough because there's been so much.
I'm asking for a lot.
Both something that meant a lot to me and everybody saw. I mean, I guess I would have to go with my first national commercial for Staples. I played the price guy. Whose name in the commercial was Willis.
So it wasn't even your real name.
No, I had to go. The character name was Willis, and it was confusing too because in the script for the auditions, he was just called Price Guy.
So that was
the character name in the script was Price Guy, but the other character, who was the store manager, called the Price Guy Willis. What do you do with that?
That's really tough. Because
that's hard.
You don't know which way to go with that.
Well, and commercials are about, iconic things.
Yeah.
So they're taking a price guy, which is, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And they're giving him an individual flavor. They're making him specific. So to both get across that I am a price guy with a price gun and also... You know, my name's Willis. I have a whole other life.
There's a whole other dimension to you than just pricing things.
Right. And then not only that is I was playing the opposite of what your stereotypical price guy would be, which is kind of grumpy. He's taking inventory. Yeah. He's pricing things. It's laborious.
He's counting the minutes.
Well, yeah, he just wants to get out, you know, so he can get a 40 or something and just forget.
And just, forget the
life. But I had to play it as a guy whose favorite thing in the world is pricing.
That's hard. That's really hard.
So when the store manager comes up with the bad news that they've lowered prices again at Staples and that... You know, I have to go and reprice everything in the store.
You just priced
just
already
as
once.
I finished the last
you
one.
Already, you just did it. You
I
already
finished
did
everything,
it.
And then he comes and he says, "You've got to do it all again." And you expect a guy to go, "Why, you fucking asshole, why?" But you twisted it. Yeah, they twisted it. It's really about the copywriters.
But it's a performance, though. Because
I had to sell it.
You know, you can't. It's like you can write that twist. But if you don't have the right person to bring it to life, it's
exactly.
Not it's just not
exactly. That's what happened with M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening. Is it was Mark Wahlberg kind of dropped the ball. Normally, I think he does a lot of prep. And he seems to care greatly about the craft, but he must have going through a bad time or something. And he didn't
scheduling.
He didn't make it 100% believable to me that the wind is terrifying.
Yeah.
If M. Night had cast me, people would still be terrified of light breezes.
No. Well, that's your.
And I'm not saying I'm a better actor than Mark Wahlberg, but I'm just saying that.
But I don't think anybody in the industry prepares as thoroughly as you do.
Clearly not.
I think that's a hallmark.
That's why that you hire me for the prep work.
What is the single greatest threat to planet Earth? And how can you solve it through acting?
Oh, that's a good question. I'd say right now the biggest threat to planet Earth is science.
Yeah.
Because you have your scientific evidence. It's proven, you know, global warming exists. But and I think that the thing that gets confused is a terror of science, and we're saying science is wrong.
Science terrors.
Yeah, because science is going to take away, you know, our spiritual beliefs. But that's really not what it is. That's just an excuse, the obvious excuse for ignoring science. But I think the truth about science is, as soon as science finds a problem, science tries to fix the problem with scientific methods, and science always goes horribly wrong.
Always, without fail.
Even when it's not being used for evil, which it usually is being used for. So, as an actor, I can play the parts that make it clear. I can play the evil scientist. I can play the good, you know, the well-meaning
the misguided scientist
who accidentally drills to the core of the Earth
and creates a black hole.
Creates a black hole, exactly. Yeah. So, as an actor, I can get that message out there, and we're the entertainment industry is good about getting that message out there.
It's the one consistent message I have seen from the entertainment industry.
Right, science it will go wrong.
Yeah,
and it always does. And as an actor, I can always be there to support that basic truth.
Name the acting role you most want to take on and tell us how you will be magnificent in it.
Okay. I had a really good time on the Liberty Mutual car washing commercial. It's a good commercial. I would like to play a dad, similar to that commercial. Washing a car, but with a 12-year-old son and a 4-year-old daughter.
Interesting. And how is that gonna elevate your performance? What's that gonna do?
Well,
what's that gonna pull out of you that we're gonna see?
I think it's gonna change the dynamic of washing the car.
Mm-hmm. Is the car still crumpled and repairing, or is it a different?
Yeah, it's the same thing. It's a sequel. It's the same guy. Years later, now he's got a daughter. His son's obviously older.
New challenges.
Yeah. There's been more damage done to the car, so he's got to wash the car. But now he's got the extra responsibility of a 4-year-old girl.
It's huge.
So he's got to make sure that she doesn't run off while he's washing the car with his son. And he also...
Because little children will run off.
They will run off.
Yeah.
They will run off, especially if they get sprayed and they don't like
soap
it.
Soap in the eye.
Yeah,
or,
yeah. Yeah. So that's the next thing I want to do.
All right, that sounds. I can't wait to see that. I hope we get to see that really soon.
I do too.
What role does your family play in making you an amazing actor?
My family. They really don't play a role in that.
Not at all.
I mean, everything that I've done that's great, I've done on my own.
Yeah.
Without help, without encouragement. And it's not that, you know, I haven't been encouraged before, but I generally say when people encourage me, I say that's not necessary.
Yeah, it's unneeded.
That's not necessary. Yeah. I'm great, and there's so many examples of my greatness that I don't need any more encouragement. I don't need any help. If anything, my family, both the family I grew up in and the family that, you know, I've created, that really just get in the way of acting, which is the tough part about having a family, as an actor, is they get in the way. And that's why a lot of Hollywood families fall apart, marriages fall apart.
Scheduling.
If you're an actor, the worst thing for an actor is other people. And that's definitely true about acting itself, which is the tough thing about the business is they always
Well, they always put you with other actors.
They put you with other actors to talk with. Yeah, and you have to, and they want you to listen to them, and you have to sell that you're listening. But
all that does is distract from your performance.
It just gets in the way. Yeah, it just gets in the way. And all the things that families do—they talk to you, and they create emotional situations, and they inform things. And there's all these things that I think a lot of actors get bogged down bringing those emotions to an imaginary circumstance and using them. And I don't do that.
Yeah.
I divorce myself from those real feelings.
That's easy. That's too easy.
It is. It's easy. You know, it's easy.
To listen and react in a natural, human emotion-centered way to the circumstances around you while giving a performance that's recorded to be projected for people to see.
Right.
I mean, come on.
Right, exactly. If there's other people, and the way the business works now, and I'm hoping this will change.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping 3D technology will and CGI will make it easier for me as an actor. The minute they remove the other actors, my performances are going to get much better.
Yeah,
and I'm not. You know, I would never get rid of my family. I mean, that's they're important. Family and friends are important.
It's the most important thing.
It is, which is why, when you're an actor, you're constantly torn in two different directions.
Yeah.
Because
absolutely.
Here are people who are, because they're forcing you to grow as a person and change and have new life experiences, your acting suffers as a result.
Mm-hmm.
And but the fact is it's very important to have friends and family. For your own personal thing.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, I think a lot of great actors, sort of divorce themselves from humanity, like Brando. And Brando got better and better.
Yeah.
The further he removed himself
Superman,
from society.
The motion picture.
Yeah. And then when he was living on his private island and he started doing the Don Juan DeMarcos and the
Island of Dr. Moreau.
It's the further he removed himself from people, the better he became, the better his movies were.
No, it's, you can't
so
argue with that.
Clearly, that's why, I love the craft and it's very important, but I don't think I'll ever be a Brando.
Well, this has been just a fascinating conversation.
I am fascinated.
I have learned so much about you, Todd Robert Anderson.
You should. I hope so.
And I only have one last question.
Okay. All right.
To bring this amazing event to a close.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What does the future hold for Todd Robert Anderson? Time travel? Tell us how time travel works.
Time travel is simple. The trick is... Have you ever traveled through time?
No, I haven't. That's...
Oh, okay. The easiest way to learn about this, how I learned about time travel, is I did a ride-along with a time cop.
Ah.
Which...
A lot of actors do ride-alongs.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was doing research for a role. I was going to do a commercial for Snickers bars, where a guy travels back in time before there were Snickers bars.
Oh,
it was ironic.
Really, kind of exciting.
Yeah, and, he had the last Snickers
bar.
And
then they're no more because they haven't been invented yet.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
Then,
and then
the twist is he invents them.
Yes,
and
he creates.
That's,
it's just,
it's,
with that. Yeah, because he has a Snickers bar. But that commercial fell through due to creative differences between me and the...
That happens. It's,
me and the director. I can be tough on director sometimes.
But you have your vision and you have to stick with it.
Right, exactly. So in any event, I did a lot of research for that, and I did a ride along with the time cop. And basically the way time travel works is you get in a small, it looks like a rocket.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a giant engine in back.
Yeah.
And you sit in it. And there's only room.
Is it open top or is it a closed?
It's a closed. They put a glass thing down over you.
Safety.
Yeah, safety. Yeah. And it's just, there's only, because you're shot through time wormholes,
mm-hmm.
Which are, they're sort of like roller coasters, sort of like Space Mountain. It's like Space Mountain, except you can't see the other tracks. It's just you're hurling through space and you're doing loop-de-loops and all that stuff in the little rocket with one other person.
Well, I get motion sickness, so...
They have wristbands with a little.
Oh, those work because I can't
pressure.
Take like a Dramamine because it
means
it's
too tired.
Stomach,
and it's too tired. And time cops obviously can't take Dramamine because they have to fight.
They have to stay alert.
Crime, time crime. When they go back.
Yeah.
So when I went, and so you go through the wormhole and there's really bright lights. And a lot of times, like, cool psychedelic colors and patterns that happen, and you fly through, and then psh, you're in another time wow. on Earth. Although we had a slight stopover in a parallel universe, which because there was some sort of problem with the time rocket, and we were in a parallel universe, which was what not was unlike. Like? Well, it was the parallel universe was so much like this one, except everyone was a lot cooler.
So it's just like really small differences.
Very small yeah. differences, but you could tell everyone was a lot cooler.
It's eerie.
Yeah, it was really eerie. But I wanted to get back to the less cool universe yeah. because there's something about cool people.
Eventually they just get on your
They
nerves.
Seem cool yeah, at first, yeah. but then they turn out to be a little bit dickish.
Yeah.
A little bit dickish. Yeah. So we got – and then we went back. He took me back to the 1950s where and he said, you know, don't touch anything because you'll alter time.
Well, that's one of the first things they tell you.
And also yeah. you can create other parallel yeah. universes with even more cool people. And they're cooler and cooler until the yeah. world is just cold.
And there's all the paperwork.
Yeah, and there's a lot yeah. of paperwork. So I didn't touch anything except I did. There was we were in a high-rise office because somebody was, you know, traveling back in time yeah. and making money off of investments. So we had
it's a good plan.
It is. It's smart.
Yeah.
But it's illegal.
Yeah.
And if they catch you...
So many smart things are illegal.
It is true. It's true. Marijuana in a lot of states. Cocaine. A lot of really smart things are illegal. Yeah. Yeah. In any event, I was very careful not to touch anything, but I did accidentally touch a decorative seashell. And when I got back here, there's been a lot of weather trouble ever since.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, that's...
And I apologize for that.
I don't think you could necessarily blame that on the seashell. That could just be a coincidence.
It could be, but the time cop that I rode with was really pissed off, and he's pretty convinced that the seashell is what has created... What a lot of people mistake for global
yeah, but
warming.
I've never come across a time cop who wasn't kind of grumpy.
They are grumpy.
They always think, you know, people are going back in time and changing things.
Yeah, they're very paranoid about
that.
But I mean, they have to be. You don't want a time cop who doesn't assume
who's,
the worst. You know,
lackadaisical.
You don't want a cuddly time cop. You need a badass.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation with television's Todd Robert Anderson on the inaugural episode of The Toncast. I'm your host, Steve Skelton, and I'd like to thank once again my guest, Todd Anderson.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been great.
This has been an amazing, informative, awe-inspiring event that I'm going to remember for the rest of my life.